CataractCoach.com, podcast number 37 with Jeffrey Tran, MD. Now, Dr. Jeffrey Tran is a young ophthalmologist who decided that, you know what? I want to start my own private practice. And he did it. And here's how he did it. Now, it may surprise you to know that your chance of success if you start a private practice is 99%. Ooh, you thought it was a coin flip, 50-50. It's 99%. And this podcast explains why. And you'll hear his whole journey through ophthalmology and how he decided this was the right move for him and how it's benefited him and his life. Now, you will choose your own best option or best path in life or in your career choice. And it's okay to change gears and change, you know, what you're doing every once in a while. But what I think you'll really enjoy from this is that he has the drive and determination just to make it happen. And there's nothing better than being your own boss. Check it out. And at the very end of the podcast, I'm going to play his YouTube video, audio and video. And that's how I found out about him. I saw a video of him explaining about his journey and starting his private practice. And I thought, wow. My cataract coach viewers would love to hear this. Check it out. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today we have an aspiring and inspiring young ophthalmologist, Jeffrey Tran. I saw a video that he made about a presentation at the ASCRS. We talked about starting his own practice, and I loved it. And I want him to be on our podcast so we can all learn from him. If you're a young ophthalmologist in your 30s or 40s, this is very important. You need to take notes. Jeffrey, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell me about your what was your journey in ophthalmology? Did you always want to do ophthalmology? Did you figure it out in med school?
Yeah, so I kind of figured out I'm in med school. I actually entered med school wanting to be a pediatric oncology. Short story short, my younger brother had leukemia growing up, so it was always an inspiration of mine to be a pediatric oncologist. But a wise pediatric mentor of mine basically told me that, hey, I'll write you a letter of recommendation only if you go to a week of family meetings. You know, with these family meetings, you break good news and, of course, you break bad news. And pediatric oncology, you don't always succeed. And that was an emotionally difficult time. So I took a step back, revisited, you know, what mattered to me. And, of course, you know, talking on this podcast, I'm sure I'm talking to many ophthalmologists. Ophthalmology is that perfect balance between medicine, surgery, and also patients tend to have very happy outcomes. And for me, that was exactly what I was looking for. So I kind of fell into ophthalmology after taking a long pause to reevaluate what mattered to me.
Oh, fantastic. So tell me about in your residency training for ophthalmology, what did you find the most interesting? What did you like the most? Which kind of surgeries? What was your passion?
I definitely would say cataract surgery. You know, though, there's nothing more satisfying than seeing a patient who has, you know, poor vision, difficulty doing the things that matter to them, you know, playing with their grandkids, driving, work. And then you do a pretty simple, elegant surgery, 15, 20 minutes, and then you restore their ability to do what matters to them. And to me, that's something special that we as ophthalmologists have the privilege of doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, back many years ago when I did my residency training, I finished the year 2000, so 23 years ago. I decided not to do a fellowship based on the advice of one of my mentors who says, before you do the fellowship, ask yourself, what exactly will you get out of the fellowship? And do you need to have the fellowship or can you learn on your own? And that became great advice because had I done, let's say, a cornea fellowship then, first, it was 2 years. For most cornea fellowships, not one. And you also didn't have all the things we do now. There was no lamellar transplantation. There was no femtosecond laser. There was no anti-VEGF. There was no OCT even. So I decided to forego a fellowship and go into practice. Now tell me about your path. Looks like you did the same.
Yeah, I guess good advice remains good advice, whether it's 23 years ago or in present day. And I got the same advice from my mentors while in residency. You know, the same thing, like, what do you want to get out of fellowship? And to me, again, that time to think about what mattered to me. And to me, I was very passionate about cataract surgery. I also wanted to be able to do a little bit of everything, right? A little bit of glaucoma, a little bit of retina, a little bit of cornea, cataract surgery. So I didn't want to just to do glaucoma or just cornea or just retina, because as soon as you commit to a fellowship, you kind of become the glaucoma guy or the cornea guy in your practice. So that's why I kind of went into comprehensive, and I love that decision, just kind of keeping everything open. And I practice in a pretty urban setting. I'm in Atlanta, and I haven't found, you know, not being fellowship trained to be a limiting factor when I was first looking for a job. After finishing residency, I joined a large group practice and had no difficulty adapting, transitioning from residency to the work life.
But then you finished residency, you joined a large group practice, and tell me about that and how that fit was and what decisions you made to leave that.
Yeah, so the group practice was overall a very good experience. I definitely learned a lot from my fellow colleagues. But for me, I think, you know, when as you know, there's been a lot of private equity acquisitions within ophthalmology. Once that kind of happened, and, you know, I realized that maybe this job that I previously loved wasn't for me anymore. And I took a step back to find, you know, what mattered to me. What makes having a solo practice pretty unique is I can really design and cater the practice to my preferences and my likings. And one of the things I really want to do is get really back into that patient-focused mindset. So in my practice right now, you know, it's still in its first year, I really get patients a lot of chair time. And the other thing that, you know, so my patient visits, you know, I get to really spend time, get to know my patients really well. And the second thing that was pretty important to me was, you know, I speak Vietnamese. And I believe I'm actually the only Vietnamese ophthalmologist in the state of Georgia, at least in the Atlanta area. And Atlanta has a pretty large Vietnamese community. And I've always had the desire to kind of serve the underserved community, and kind of being able, my own solo practice owner, I can kind of create the support staff that I need to cater to the Vietnamese community. So that includes hiding front desks that speak English and Vietnamese, and also crafting a lot of my, you know, handouts. I actually use videos in my exam lane too. So when patients are dilating, I throw up a Vietnamese YouTube video about cataracts, about dry eyes. So they're dilating, starting, they're learning about basic eye health. So again, it's really having the ability to cater that practice to exactly how I want to.
Yeah, it's interesting to think. Yeah, there's a big change with the private equity. And I think the younger ophthalmologists feel like they kind of get left out of the whole situation, that they don't want to be a permanent, like, employee status only and have the private equity people kind of be your boss in perpetuity.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that sentiment. You know, I think the way I talk about jobs when my friends are asking me, like, what type of job I get, the answer is there's no one perfect type of job. Right. I think you can probably find happy colleagues in academics, in a Kaiser setting, the VA, in solo practice, like, you know, myself. So there is no one right job. But for me, when I looked at what set being solo or being in private practice apart, was really having that control and being able to really, you know, make impactful decisions to, you know, better improve patient care. And I think being in either a small private practice group or even in a solo practice, you have the most mobility versus a large academic setting. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's a lot more red tape and there's a lot more things you have to navigate to get the things that you want to get done.
Right. It's been said that a big group is like a big ship. It's really hard to change direction. It's very gradual. Whereas a small group or solo practice is like a small little speedboat. You can change directions instantly.
100%. 100%. I agree.
I also remember, too, I always tell my former residents that every big group practice started off as a solo practice. This is how it's done.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so even these big groups now, which are 30 or 40 or 50 doctors, started off with just the one doctor or maybe two and just a small little group, and they grow it. And there is something great about having that autonomy. Like I always say, the good news is I'm my own boss. The bad news is my boss is really tough.
I agree with that. And the beauty of being a solo owner is like, right now I'm still trying to feel what I like best. I don't know if I want to keep this a one doctor practice. I don't know if I want to bring on a fellow optometrist or add multiple different partners later on. That's the beauty of it. I have flexibility. I have time to decide. There is no, hey, by year two, year three, you have to hire the next associate. I kind of really get a feel for, like, what do I want to do? And the answer is I don't know right now, but I at least get to, you know, explore that process and really think about what matters to me, and, you know, kind of shift, you know, shifting the practice in the way that I think is best for patient care.
I think that's very important to be able to do that. And remembering too that every practice, yours, mine, and everyone else's, evolves with time. And the way we do surgery now is not the way we're going to do in the future. And even the way we do our practice now, the first 6 years after I finished my training, I did everything from strabismus to ptosis repair to diabetic lasers to cataracts, obviously, glaucoma, cornea. I did everything. Whatever walked in the door. And then later decided, like, let me just hone this down. Honestly, for the last like 15 or 17 years, I do nothing but cataract and refractive. So any practice, yours included and mine, can always is always in that state of evolution.
100%, and you can kind of find what you know what you're passionate about, right? So I agree. You kind of like kind of catered your practice, and really, since you're your own boss, right? You can really decide what type of patients you want to take care of, and what type of procedures, surgeries, or medical services that you offer. So again, the flexibility of being in solo.
Right. And there's one other really important, powerful thing you have as being a small group or a solo practitioner is the ability to say no. If I have a patient who comes in for an elective surgery, and I just know for whatever reason, we're on different wavelengths, I know I just cannot make her happy. Or I'm trying to fix psychiatric disease with a phaco probe, I could kindly bow and say, you know, I'm not the surgeon for you. But if you're in a big group, especially in a capitated group, you may not have that ability.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Flexibility is key. And I think that's actually, one of the most important things that, honestly, looking at myself 1 to 2 years ago versus now, is that flexibility. It's the difference between going to a 9-to-5 job and working through the grind and truly being passionate and invigorated to practice ophthalmology again. Every day that I go into the office, I feel that energy, that pep, what makes you love being a doctor. I found it again. And it's because I have that flexibility, and I want to do this, I can do it, versus, man, my boss tells me, my partners tell me I have to do this. It's that whole control, who's controlling your schedule, controlling your decisions. That control is the difference between being content and being very fulfilled.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, it's not easy. In fact, one of the dumbest things that I've said many in my life, when I was a senior resident, I said, I can't wait till I'm in practice. It'll be so much easier. Oh, my goodness. That's crazy talk. Because solo practice is much harder than residency. There are different challenges.
Tell 100%.
Me about that. Tell me about that. What have been the big challenges for you?
Well, the biggest challenge is, like, in residency and in medical school, correct me if I'm wrong, we definitely don't get that real world lecture, right? Like, how to run a business, how to do, just business, period. It's like a giant void in our medical training. All ophthalmologists, right? We can take care of any crazy diabetes, any glaucoma, open globe injuries. But you ask an ophthalmologist, hey, how do you form an LOC? What's the difference between an LOC and an S-corp? How do you get XYZ done? The answer is that probably most of us don't know. And to be honest, I didn't either. But I think the biggest key about surviving and making the transition is knowing what you're good at and knowing what you don't know. And for me, that's why I hired a consultant early on, because I realized what my deficiencies were, and I knew that there was so much of the unknown that I needed help. And with that, I've been able to really accelerate the growth of my practice.
Tell me about your consultant. I wasn't even aware these things kind of existed. Specific to ophthalmology?
What actually started me on this solo journey was I was talking to one of my colleagues at my old private equity job. And he told me, hey, Jeff, you're not going to believe this. Solo ophthalmology is a thing and it can exist. And of course, just like any ophthalmologist in residency, I was definitely told there's no way solo ophthalmology can survive in these days. And then I discovered the solo blog. I think Howie Chen and Ho Sun were authors of the blog 10, 15 years ago. And it's a rich source of information, and other eye doctors who are solo have chimed in. And then I started reading. I was like, oh, there's a lot of doctors who are doing this, and even more recently, that have all been very successful. And so I kind of started reading through that blog, and I found out that one of the founders of that blog started his own consulting firm. And, as a curious an unhappy associate in practice, I reached out on a cold email. Hey, I'm interested in finding out what you can offer for someone like me. And we chatted it up, spoke to a few more colleagues that he had helped along the way, so, you know, talked to other solo ophthalmologists around the country. And I really found that, hey, this isn't just something that can survive. It actually is thriving. And I think a good point that someone brought up to me is, like, if you think about how many solo ophthalmologists you know that close their doors within the first 2 years, I can't think of really any right now on top of my head, right? But if you talk about how many associates leave their jobs within the first 2 years, it's over 50%. Mm-hmm. So the failure rate of joining an associate practice is literally 50% versus going solo. Of course, self-selecting, some biases, but if you want it, you can make it happen. I think that's a good point.
It's a great point. Yeah. I don't know of a single person who went out and started solo who didn't make it. Not one. More than 20 years of practice.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it just comes down to, you know, great patient care and passion, and everything just kind of works. You know, like, it's, you know, patients notice your passion, patients notice your care, your time and your commitment, and that's what leads to growth of practice. Of course, some practices may be busy within the first 1 to 2 years. Others may take a little bit longer, but at the end of the day, to your point, they all end up succeeding. And I think that's the beautiful part of it.
I think it's so driven in our heads as, you know, lifelong students, top students in high school, top in college, go to med school, top in med school just to get into ophthalmology. We just know if we work hard enough, we can make anything happen. No matter how big the test is, if we study hard enough, we can do well on a test. And this is kind of like the ultimate test. We just got to put in the effort and work hard, and it will actually take off.
Yeah. And I think one key point that really made me hesitant at going solo was, you know, the, I guess, the financial side, right? Like, how am I going to be able to survive within the first 2 years where I'm not making any income, right? But after, you know, running the numbers and looking at it myself, really a lot of practice can actually break even within the first year. Running my numbers, it was probably about within 4 to 5 months in before I actually made enough money to pay rent, pay my EMR, pay employees. So really by 5 to 6 months, you kind of break even. And that was a very special moment. Of course, now as, you know, more patients added to my schedule, I'm breaking that curve. Of course, I'm not ahead of where I was in as associate, but the trajectory is amazing. And I think for once you talk to other solo ophthalmologists who've made that journey, looking at your financial prospects years 5 in, years 7 in, years 10 in, having that 100% ownership, it's really astounding how much money you're leaving on the table by not being your own business owner.
No, absolutely. Plus, the other thing is the autonomy allows you to actually 100%. Achieve a better work-life balance. So when you have a young family and you know, hey, you know what, next week Thursday or next week Friday is this event at school, you can just take the afternoon off. Because in your other job,
100%.
Right?
100%. I have two little kids, both under 3. And to me, that work-life balance was one of the most important things to me. You know, like, you might hear my little toddler actually crying in the background. I actually just put him to bed a few minutes ago. But to me, that work-life balance is one of the most important things. And that's actually why, you know, kind of fell into ophthalmology, because ophthalmology is one of those really well-known work-life balance specialties. And being a solo practitioner gives you that control and your flexibility, right? Do you want to work 4 days a week? You absolutely can. Do you want to be busy and do some Saturdays every other month? That's up to you. There's no one telling you how to run your practice. And that's what makes it special.
Right. I mean, it can be a little tough though, because you end up being such a tough boss. When I was in the beginning stage of my practice, first couple of years, I did 6 days a week. I worked Saturdays. It was supposed to be Saturday mornings, but those mornings went to like 3 p.m.
Yeah.
And then I also did 2 evening clinics, Tuesdays and Thursdays, that see patients until 8 p.m. A lot of people want to be seen after work, sort of miss work.
Yeah. And that's the beauty. Right? Go ahead. Yeah. And that's the beauty of it, right? For me, like, I took the opposite approach. I said, you know what? Like, I'm going to tell patients Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and no patients on the weekends. Yes, of course, doing your way may accelerate my growth a little bit more. But for me, being able to go home and hang out with my two little kids was very important. And also during the first year or two as you're growing, right, you're not seeing a full template, right? So you can cluster all your patients in the morning and mm-hmm. all your patients in the afternoon. And guess mm-hmm. what? In the morning or afternoon when you have that whole half day off, you can go back to, you know, the networking, meeting fellow doctors, primary cares, optometry referrals, or you can go home and hang out with your family and your kids. I want to be able to watch my kids grow up. So to me, solo, despite its scariness, I guess, of making that jump, has given me that flexibility. As a new dad, that's so critical to me.
Yeah, I can't tell you enough that you really got to maximize your enjoyment with your kids. In 20 years, Jeffrey, you're going to be in my shoes, 50-something, empty nester, and you're going to miss your kids every day.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely doing it the right way. This is, in retrospect, I wish I would have, if I could go back, I would have a better balance and spend more time. The time you just can't get back.
100%, right? Because I think as ophthalmologists, we can keep practicing to our 50s, 60s, and so on, but our kids, they're only like preschool age for so long. They're only toddler age for so long. That's a very short window in the grand scheme of things. And that's why I'm trying to, you know, use that flexibility of being a solo owner to spend time with my family and my kids. Of course, I'm still going out, networking, meeting fellow doctors. But, you know, if I'm not doing that, I'm spending time with my family. And to me, that's priceless. It really is. And that's, again, the difference between me being content a few years ago to being actually very fulfilled and happy now.
Yeah, there's a difference. Absolutely. You mentioned about, you know, going out in the community, meeting doctors, et cetera. How do you drum up business? How do you get referrals?
Yeah. So it's the old school knock on a fellow doctor's door and be like, hey, my name is Jeffrey Trent. I'm an ophthalmologist located, you know, this, about a couple minutes to your house. I always bring treats. I'm a sweet tooth guy, so I always bring little pastries just so they remember a little bit more. And it's all about being available, right? I give the every referring doctor my personal cell phone, and I tell them, hey, if you have something emergent, give me a call 24/7. I'll take care of your patient for you. And I think referring doctors like having someone available. Of course, then you can show your ability, right? Someone has red eyes, cataract, glaucoma, angle closure glaucoma, and you take care of them, they go back to their primary care doctor and they rave, man, Dr. Tran did this for me. That's what builds up that referral, that builds up that trust. And you just being that available doctor, because again, your schedule is wide open. If you're a new guy, you can schedule anyone anytime. They remember that, right? If a primary care doctor is someone with pink eye, something as simple as conjunctivitis, they want their patient taken care of. And if the nearest group can only see them within a week, but you can see them that day, that's how you grow. And that's why a new practice actually succeeds, because you can really fill in all those add-on very quickly. And again, I've only done the 8 to 5 on weekends, depending on what's going on. I can probably push things till Monday and they still love that availability.
You know, that's a great point. One of the things that I would do for referring doctors, if you have a patient, whatever the eye issue is, any primary care doctor, I'll see him today. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll see him during my lunch break. I'll see him before clinic. I will see your patient today. Just send him over. And I think that makes a world of difference.
It is. And it's that's the high standard of customer service to your referring doctors, right? What do you want done? You want it done right away? You can be that guy that gets it done right away. And that's how practices really boom.
Right. And sometimes you forget that when you're doing all your training, your residency, you're working so hard, you forget little things like that patient who comes to you with the metallic foreign body in the cornea from working, grinding metal on his car and working in his yard. He has 2 grandmas and 2 grandpas, and that's 8 vacos, you know?
100%. Yeah, and it's even like the simple diabetic eye exams, like those, that's if you treat every patient like it's your only patient, they go home and they tell their family members. And for me, a lot of my patients bring drivers. So their family driver who's listening to the conversation sees that level of care that you can really provide to your patients. Most of them actually book appointments that same day when they're checking out with their family members. So usually it's a one patient comes in, two appointments are made by the time they're out the door. So that's that customer service, that attention to detail and really showing patients you care. It goes a long way.
Yeah, the growth at the beginning really happens a lot faster than you think.
It does.
And then the important part is you're building it on the most important way, which is word of mouth. So much better than advertising or promotion or online stuff. The word of mouth, you just can't beat.
100%. Like, I haven't done any advertising. Google sent me a $500 gift card to do a Google ad, and I tried it out. And really, it's all word of mouth. That's definitely the difference maker. And honestly, when you take care of a patient, they go to their primary care doctor. That's when things get rolling, because now the primary care doctor has their diabetic eye guy. There's someone who has blurred vision. They send to you. That's how your practice gets really busy. And you know, patients will travel if they know that you're a good doc. They can get them seen that day. You know, I have patients traveling 30, 40 minutes, an hour plus away because you can see them that day. That's the difference maker.
Yeah, well, in LA they can do 30 minutes to an hour, but that may only be like 3 miles. Given the traffic.
That's true.
So you're mostly, again, I guess it's primary care doctors or your most referrals, or maybe optometrists too. Where are you getting the most referrals from?
I think the biggest referrals is definitely primary care. In the Georgia area, there's been a lot of acquisitions of optometry practices. So a lot of optometry practices that are already affiliated with some larger private equity backed group. But primary care doctors tend to be independent. They use their clinical judgment and, you know, availability, and, you know, they decide who they think is, you know, the best doctor for their patients. And I think that's why most of my referrals have come from primary care doctors. And to me, that's actually what I value the most, because I want to be able to I feel like the referrals from optometry groups are going to be very surgery procedure based, right? Because optometrists, they're great colleagues. They know how to take care of diabetes, glaucoma, but they may not be able to provide, you know, surgeries like for cataracts. So they send you for cataract surgeries and you send them back. That may help kind of build that referral network, but I think as a patient practice builder, it's definitely the diabetic eye exam, the routine eye exams that from your primary care doctors, because that patient, if they're glaucoma suspect, they're going to come back in 6 months. If they're a diabetic eye exam, they come back once a year. These are the ones that become really good, consistent referring patients, and they bring their family members. So, because diabetes is a very common disease, right? So odds are if you're 65 and you have diabetes, your family members probably have diabetes too. So it quickly balloons in terms of your volume and your patient growth.
For sure. Now, before you decided to set up, did you save like X number of months, 6 months or 12 months of expenses? Or how did you determine when you had enough to start?
Yeah, so I kind of thought about this process a little slowly over the time of about a year or so. So, you know, with your typical associate job, I really was putting everything straight to the bank, because I was trying to, I knew at a certain point that, hey, this isn't for me. I'm going to try to look for the next big thing. So put a lot of it into a savings account so I could remain liquid. And to set up a practice, I think people are overestimating how much it costs to get a practice up and running. For a single doctor practice, all you really need is 1500 square foot to 2000 square foot, right?
Okay.
So rent is very market dependent. So you know, New York versus Atlanta is gonna be way different. So, but smaller, one exam lane is really what you need. In terms of diagnostic equipment, I went pretty slim at first. You know, I have a visual field machine, and OCT, the Zeiss series system. I actually have a YAG laser, an Argos biometer, and together everything was about $120,000-$130,000. You can go used for a lot of equipment, because that Lensstar, I bought Lensstar first, then the Argos later, but that Lensstar, even if it's near to use, it's still going to get the same accurate measurements. I was very familiar with the Lensstar because that's what we used at my last practice. So when I first transitioned to my new practice, I just bought pretty much the same equipment that I had my old office, and used in great condition. All comes with 1 or 2 year warranty, again, for about $130,000. And I think I broke down the numbers of what each thing costs on my video that I presented at Ascaris.
Ryan, that was a great video. We'll try to feature that here at the end of our podcast. So if you're listening to the podcast on audio only, you may want to check out the link on cataractcoach.com or on YouTube so you can see the video of the presentation as well. So did you start off with then just very small, then one lane or two lanes?
Still with one lane. You know, like my clinic flow can right now, you know, seeing 6, 7, 8 a day can easily still do one lane, right? Yeah, if you let's just assume 1 hour a patient, right? You can have the patient dilating in that room. It's not going to be an issue. Really, I think the one lane, if you maximize your space well, bring them into the waiting room, dilation space, et cetera, you can easily go to like keep that one lane for a long time. So, you know, simple waiting room. So my office set up front desk area, waiting room in a different section, two different diagnostic rooms, you know, one with like, you know, all my biometry, OCTs, things that keep in a dark space, my auto refractor, et cetera, keeping a more like, you know, well lit space. So two separate rooms for that. Of course, I have my own personal office, an exam room, a break room, and actually two spare rooms in the very back that I don't use anything just to, for storage for right now. So the space, if you get
room expand then.
Yeah, room to expand. So the room can go to 2 to 3 exam lanes, but it's only been 10 months in. I'm already thinking about my next move in terms of opening up a second office just because the growth has been that good.
Wow, that'll be amazing. You get a second location going as well.
Yes.
Fantastic. So yeah, I think that's a smart move to start simple. When I did it first solo so many years ago, I bought all used equipment as cheap as possible. Sometimes we're spoiled in residency. You're using these fancy hog strides, slit lamps. And when you go into practice, you see how expensive they are. You're like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So you get other brands. Initially. Go ahead.
Yeah. New and used. I mean, the best way is going to Academy or Aspis and just kind of playing with the instruments and seeing what you like best. And again, that's why these national meetings are great, because every vendor's there, you kind of see what you like. And that's how I was able to kind of find out like, oh, I know this costs X amount of dollars versus this thing. Let me try the two. And you realize that, yeah, there are some things that are more cost conscious, but if you as a surgeon have a preference for this machine, just make the transition as comfortable as you can and go for what you like. So for me, I knew I liked certain lenses. I knew I liked certain, diagnostic machines. So I stuck to that brand because that's just, you know, my preference. So I didn't want to add a second X factor to make the transition from my old practice to my new one.
For sure. And then you start off small with a number of employees, probably initially just one person, probably.
Actually, when I first started out, it was just me at first. I didn't actually hire my first employee to about 6, 7 months in. And I think patients were initially shocked, and actually pleasantly happy, because when they answer their phone call, hello, this is Dr. Tran at Stratus Eye. How can I help you? And like, oh, are you the actual doctor? Of course. And they realize that that's that extra level of care. And you can provide that. If you only have, when you're first starting out, you're not expecting to see 10, 20 patients a day, right? Reality is you have one patient a day. And so that one patient is your 100% all energy in, right? That means you can do their PA, you can do their scheduling, you can verify their insurance. These are things that you learn on your own and you quickly get good at doing these things, and patients really appreciate that. Hey, as a doctor, you're getting, they have a work letter, it's done within a minute. You have a prior authorization submitted that same day. Scheduling done right then by you and there. And it just, that's again, that's the, I mean, I wouldn't say the difference maker, but that's the, that's what allows your growth to grow well. But patients pay attention to these things.
Absolutely. And then to your point there, if you run such a lean ship, you don't need too many patients a day to break even. You need very little.
Yeah. The numbers are very shocking. I think for my practice, my specific setup, 4 patients a day, just 4 annual diabetic exams was enough to really pay off my expenses. And that includes a recurring cost with, you know, my EMR, my rent, my utilities. You know, that's really all it takes. Everything on top of that is now profit. So it's a nice flexibility. And again, if you're seeing 20, 25 a day, just doing 5 cataracts a week, that's a very, very healthy income stream coming in.
Yeah. In fact, you mentioned 5 cataracts a week, and people are sometimes surprised to find out that the average ophthalmologist in the US, general ophthalmologist, is doing somewhere around that level, 5, 6, 7 cataracts in a week. Not doing these 50 cataracts a week that you kind of hear about in these glorified, unusual.
Yeah. No, and to me, like I, you know, the best part of it is all like I'm not actively looking for cataract patients. They come to me just because they have blurred vision. For me, I'm just trying to, you know, do my thing as an ophthalmologist, take care of them, do their annual eye exam, something as simple as, you know, they have dry eyes, they have a family history of glaucoma, someone they know had a retinal detachment, so they're just wanting to be seen to make sure their eyes are fine. That's to me, that's the patients that I enjoy taking care of, because I really, you know, as I'm dialing their eyes, I find about their life history. You know, like, hey, oh, so you're from blah blah blah. I see your phone numbers from here. I really get to know them really well. And so my patients are more than a number. I know them very well and they know me well. And I think that's what, again, makes me love being an ophthalmologist again. Because it's, you know, whenever you get that moment where you're feeling kind of burnt out, take a look at your medical school personal statement, right? Why did you make this journey to go into 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency, 1 or 2 more years of fellowship? And in everyone's personal statement, I guarantee it, talks about patients, patient care, or some patient that inspired them to go to medical school.
Right.
And so when
Absolutely.
you are, yeah, when you are now as a solo practitioner and you get to know your patients very well, you know their life story, you know, not, you know, patient MRN MM00XXX, it's Mrs. Smith, right? And you know everything about Mrs. Smith. She knows about you. So when she calls, I know, oh yeah, Mrs. Smith, I know her chart. And it just makes that again, extra attention to detail. Patients love it. But more importantly, for you as the ophthalmologist, I love what I do again. And I'm very proud to say that.
Yeah, you can't say that enough. I mean, it really is that important. In fact, I had a funny story. I guess I even now, 23 years into practice, I still know my patients very well. And so I had a recent thing where my kids were in town for a Christmas break because they go to school on the East Coast. They came home and we went to Costco together. And in Costco, two people stopped me and said, "Dr. Devin, oh, you did, and you remember me? You did my surgery." And then they looked at my kids and said, "You know, your dad gave me such incredible vision." And then a second patient, that same Costco trip, said the same thing. And my kids are like, "Dad, whoa."
Yeah.
But to your point, it's knowing that you know your patients, and that's why they're so comfortable in sending their families and their friends to you.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, that's not saying that you can't get that same patient physician connection at a larger group or working at, you know, academics, VA, Kaiser. I just feel like as a sole practice group, since you don't need to see as much volume to do as well, it gives you that better ability to do so. So, you know, when you don't have to see as many patients, you can really spend more time with your patients. So, you know, not discrediting any other job selection out there. I just feel like as a solo group, we have that greater ability to for that chair time.
You know, great point. I think there are different kind of jobs out there. They all have the right fit. So it's up to the resident or the recent graduate to say, hey, you know, what's the right fit for me? And importantly, your first job may be like your first girlfriend or boyfriend, great and all, but may not be the one you're with forever. And that's okay also.
100%. And I think the best way to think about it is if you think back to now your first year of medical school, in your medical class of 100 plus people, how many ophthalmologists were there? Only a handful, right? Everyone kind of finds their own niche, right? Whether, you know, your classmates going into pediatrics, general medicine, general surgery, psychiatry, et cetera, right? But for me, I probably wouldn't be as happy if I was in that specialty or this specialty. So everyone's got to really find what matters to them, and you know what is the most important thing to you, and really, you know, go for it, right? Don't do like for me. If I was forced to do, no, let's just say pediatrics, like the field I was considering, right? I may not have been as happy now. I probably would have made it work, but may not have been as fulfilled and for happy. So, for everyone listening out there, you know, really find what matters to you. It may not be going solo. It's just something to consider. I think that's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I wanted to bring you on the podcast because, like I said, I enjoyed your lecture, but more importantly, so that young ophthalmologists, cataract coach skews younger. Well, most of our viewers, as you probably guessed, are like, we have a lot of residents who watch, let's say late 20s to probably you know, late 40s. It's kind of the main range of where cataract coach viewers are.
Yes.
There's some older ones that watch as well, some med students even, but in general it's that. I just want to bring that there to them, the idea that there is another option. you can do academics, you can do big group, you can do some capped HMO, you can do a solo practice from scratch. And I promise the odds are probably 99% or more, you will succeed.
And I think that's the, that's the point of this whole conversation. You nailed it on the head. That's, you know, there's so many options out there. Find what's right for you, and solo can survive. And solo can do more than survive. They can actually thrive and be very successful.
Right. How did you decide to perhaps open a second location? What's the impetus behind that?
So looking at the second location, kind of based on one, shortening the commute. There's a couple things that kind of determine where I opened my first practice. You know, first of all, in Georgia, there's non-competes. So there are non-competes. So you have to respect a certain radius away from your old location. So my first office location was in a good spot, but a little bit further than I would like for my day-to-day drive. Like I live, you're from California, so I'm sure your commute's much longer. But for me, 35 minutes to 40 minutes is a long time. And I want to shorten that commute down to a lot, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. The second thing is that this location not only would shorten my commute, but more importantly, be kind of closer to where the bulk of my referring primary care doctors have come from. And I think by being closer to my main referral sources, it will help drive the growth of my practice in years 2, 3, 4, and et cetera. So that's patient growth, shortening commute. Those are the two big factors.
No, I agree. Those are very important issues. I mean, I have a bit of a commute from where I live, but I do it by doing crazy hours. So I'll leave home at 4:30 for my surgery days. I'll get to the surgery center about 5 o'clock in the morning. And by 5:45, I'm already cutting. And so I just start early and then I'll finish early. I'll finish by about 1 p.m. for the surgeries for that morning. So we've just kind of learned to live with it. But yeah, no, I definitely see your point there. And yeah, you can certainly expand to that. Do part-time in each facility. And then it gives you room to grow. So then you can get an associate, let's say, down the road, whether an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, and then expand even further because now you've got two locations. So you don't have to double up manpower at one location.
Absolutely. I agree with that. You know, it's again, flexibility. You have all the options on the table. You decide what you want to do. So, let's just say the second location isn't the best fit for me. Like, okay, maybe I don't like this. Right? You can quickly pick up, set up a new location and kind of determine how you make the decision. You make the judgment call, what's best for you and your practice.
Now, when you went and chose your space, you had to find the space, you sign a lease, you probably had to do tenant improvements or a build out. Kind of take us through a little bit of that process, how long it took.
Yeah, so the unit I rented out was a previous consulting firm. I think they were selling products. It was more of a classic office. And, you know, the layout was actually okay. I found a room space that was like bigger than 10 by 10. I made that into my exam lane and actually have a short YouTube video where I actually just like make a fun, like 30-second clip of me actually renovating the office. You know, I had some time off in between my old job and this one with the help of my father-in-law. You know, I did everything from painting, putting some laminate floors in, putting a feature wall in to kind of really make the place look a lot more homey. And it's a little bit of TLC, getting that office ready for your first patient. But really, I was fortunate enough that I didn't have to do any major knocking of walls. Unlike our dentist colleagues, who opening up a new office is challenging because all the plumbing involved. As an ophthalmologist, I was like, IKEA is my best friend. The equipment's so fast to build. That acoustic panel that you see in the back corner, small, simple touches that look very good, easy to put up, and it actually is functional too because it helps absorb a lot of sound. Because if you have a hardwood floor, there's so much noise bouncing everywhere. The acoustic panel looks great, absorbs sound, and it really makes it look very boutique, high-end practice. I think one thing I looked at in terms of modeling my office was that there's a popular dental chain called Mint, I think, where Mint and 10 are the two ones that come to mind, where it's kind of an upscale dentist practice. I kind of want to go for that visual impact, whites and warm woods. And, you know, the crazy thing is, like, it's a lot of my furniture was very simple IKEA ones, but then you can buy exterior facades for these things to make a simple Billy bookshelf into something very luxe. So I bought a bunch of things and made the best shelving to this very interior doors from Norse Interior, made it look very, very nice. Get a couple of legs, raise it up off the ground, and it really pops.
Well, I love that you're so hands-on. I mean, I'll tell you, me too. This last weekend in my house, I changed my kitchen faucet myself. I don't need a plumber. It's not that hard.
Yeah, there you go.
But yeah, doing some hands-on stuff, then you really have that pride of ownership. You know, like, hey, I did this.
It does. And it's a fun conversational piece. When patients come in, they're like, wow, this axiom wall looks really good. How much did you pay a contractor to do it? Like, well, actually, Mrs. Smith, I did it myself. And I like talk about how I did it. And sometimes you find a carpenter, right? That's a patient of yours. And if you can really talk about hobbies and they know you're a genuine person, you actually did it, that patient trusts you a little bit more. And they're like, man, Dr. Tran was a great doctor, but guess what? He's also a pretty cool person too. And that's, you know, that's what I love doing. I like taking care of eyes. I like cataract surgery, but I get so easily distracted with small talk. And, you know, for example, anything from building furniture, college football. I'm a Georgia Bulldog fan. So small things like that, I can get sidetracked pretty easily.
Now, talking about surgery, do you operate in a surgery center, in a hospital? Did you get hospital privileges? You don't need them. What did you decide to do with that?
So it's not all you know, green grass and roses. That's the most difficult part about transitioning to a solo practice is finding where to operate. Luckily, in Atlanta, there's a couple of pretty large a large hospital system that also has an outpatient surgery center. The difficult thing was finding OR time. But, you know, because like, you know, Monday morning will be Dr. X, Monday afternoon will be Dr. Y, Tuesday morning, Dr. Z. But what I typically do is if a patient needs cataract surgery and I know that I'm trying to do surgery within a week or two, I just call the surgery center like, hey, is Dr. X using her entire block? Is there an opening at 11 o'clock? Because I know her last schedule is supposed to start at 11 o'clock. I'm like, oh, actually, she has opening starting at 10:30. We can call Dr. X if she can release the last surgery case of the block. And sometimes Dr. X goes on vacation. Guess what? Now you have spots for 8 cataract surgeries. So that's what I've actually been doing. So, and most of my patients are willing to wait just a little bit longer because they know that you really are passionate and care about their eyes. And so you can be like, hey, instead of doing surgery this week, it may be 2 weeks from now. That's actually okay. You have a little bit of, and I always, you know, it's always, you know, spinning in a positive direction, right? Your eyes are just a touch dry. You have a little bit of, you know, blepharitis. Let's focus on that. So when you're done with cataract surgery, I mean, before we get a cataract surgery, we really optimize your your cornea. They're like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. And they love it. So it's, taking something that's, you know, a potential problem and spinning it and making it to a positive thing. So that's what I've actually been able to do. I think, you know, again, I'm in a good situation where the ASC that I work with is pretty flexible. I can call them and find, you know, hey, it's Dr. X, Dr. Y. I'm using their time. And it's really helpful to get to know your fellow ophthalmologists in your area. Most of them are very warm, very friendly. Like, they'll actually will call me, hey, Jeffrey, I know you're new in the area. I'm actually going to be on vacation these weeks in 2 to 3 months and ahead, so I can actually plan already ahead. So, you know, the ophthalmology community has been very supportive as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, for those who may not realize, you're not just born with block time. You have to kind of work your way into it. So
yeah,
doing what you're doing now until you have a more steady pace of patients. And then at the beginning, I remember I would take, they'd say, okay, we got Friday block time. Friday is the easiest because no one wants to see Saturday post-ops. But I didn't mind seeing Saturday post-ops. So I take the 100%. Friday
one. 100%.
Do you have hospital privileges as well, or you don't need that?
I have hospital privileges as well, but I haven't really had to utilize it. The hospital system I work with has an ASC. They actually do offer the ability to do cataract surgery in their main surgery OR in the hospital. But for me, I just try to stick to the ASC. It's just a little bit easier for my patients. So that's I haven't had the need where I had a patient that really needed surgery that day or that week where I had to like take whatever was available. I've been just using the ASC.
Right. So yeah, I think sometimes it was, I found it helpful at the beginning to do hospital privileges just to get to know the ER docs. And then I just tell them, hey, if you have any of these eye patients, because I don't know a single ER doctor who actually wants to see an ophthalmology patient.
No, 100%, 100%, I think that also kind of shows you, the different ways to run, set up your solo practice, right? I know you probably did, it seems like you did rely on, a little bit of ER referrals to kind of jumpstart your practice.
Yeah.
At the hospital that I work with, a large group already with like 20, 30 doctors already is the go-to practice for any ophthalmologist. So anytime the ER has an issue, they call, practice XYZ, and they already send it to them. So they actually aren't looking for ophthalmologists to cover the ER. But then again, my practice is still growing at a reasonable rate. Not having that ER referral hasn't been a detriment to the growth in my practice is what I'm trying to say. So
for sure, there's so many different ways that you can get patients. We talk about a lot, whether it's for primary care, optometrist, and the big, big one, obviously, is word of mouth. We talk about what didn't kind of work, because the Google stuff, that's kind of hit or miss, But then also, ER patients, et cetera. But I think, ultimately, the best is the way you're doing it. Because the word of mouth, it takes time to build the momentum in your practice. But like a train, Absolutely. Once momentum is built, once you have that strong momentum, that train is unstoppable.
Absolutely. And don't forget always the your optometry colleagues too. I think they're a great source too. Some of them may be affiliated with certain groups or already have a strong connection with a surgeon, and that's okay. But just always show that you're available. Sometimes they really need a patient seen that day. And guess what? If you're there to see that angle closure glaucoma, that optometrist may be sending you a lot more patients your way. And that's also been very helpful too. And so I'm always very appreciative of any time I get a referral. It's simple, right? Simple things. I call my referring optometrist, my primary care doctors. Hey, I saw Mrs. Smith today. She has XYZ. We're taking care of her. And then, just so they're up to date, they just want to know that their patients are taken care of, and they appreciate that aspect.
Absolutely. I think I had heard a lecture when I was just starting practice from Dick Lindstrom. And Dick Lindstrom said, remember the four or five A's of success for our practice. Number one is what you said, availability. Number two is ability. You have to have the skills. Yep. Number three, I think it was affability. You got to be nice. You got to be likable. And then I can't remember all of them. But
those were the three that were taught to me also in residency. And it's just, you want to say common sense, but not everyone, thinks about that readily, but it almost is, it's just like, what your mama taught you, right? So just be nice, be polite, always be there, right?
What's been the hardest thing for you starting off this practice? Was it just the initial kind of leap of faith? What's the toughest part so far in the first almost year?
I think it's the, it's always the uncertainty, right? The biggest challenge of getting a practice up and rolling is you may be busy, but you may not get paid for your patients. So it comes down with credentialing, right? So for example, if a primary care doctor is sending a patient with XYZ, and let's just pick on Aetna just for fun, right? If I'm not in network with Aetna, I'm not going to turn, for me, I decided not to turn that patient because I know that by taking care of this patient with Aetna, I'm not going to get paid. That's okay. But that patient goes back to the primary care doctor, tells them about the experience. That patient will send someone that I'm in network with, right? And some insurers are very quick at getting you credentialed, right? Some patients, I was in network with a few by month two, month three, and it's still month 10, and I'm still not insured with a couple plans here and there, but that's okay. At this point, I'm insured with, 90 to 95% of the referrals that are coming in. The part of it. So yes, some visits you're not getting paid. So it can be, frustrating when you feel like you've dedicated the time and you feel like you should be compensated. But for me, I count that as my advertising budget, right? 92904, $150. That goes back to their patient. I just think in my head, okay, that's $150 in my advertising. It's certainly a lot more effective than my $500 I spend on Google, I'd say. So
yeah, that's actually a great point, because sometimes you don't realize how these things can take time.
Yeah.
Sometimes
100%
things
so, but I think it's all about keeping a positive attitude and knowing hey, there are some days when you get a lot of phone calls and a lot of referrals and you're busy, and other days you're not quite as busy, but it's realizing the averages all work out. And to your point, right, I think 99% of solo practices will succeed, and just trust the process, right? I guess it goes back to, as a resident, right? You see your amazing attending do cataract surgery. There's no way I'm ever going to be able to do this. Like, I can't even like get my lens and I mean my scope in focus, right? But then by the end of it, you just trust the process. You do a little bit more here and there. You eventually get comfortable doing cataract surgery. Now you're on your own doing, you know, 10, 20, et cetera, cataracts a week. And then everything, you just got to trust the process. If trust me, I'm not that special. If I can do it, then certainly you can too. So
that's one of my favorite lines too, as I'm not that special. I'm hard working, but no, I think you're doing an amazing job. I'm really, really proud of you. And I think you're going to keep climbing. Your star is definitely rising.
Yeah. Well, thank you for those kind words.
So I want to encourage our audience. If you want to have more information about this, there are some good resources online. You can Google. We mentioned a few in here. You can certainly contact Dr. Tran as well. We'll put a link down below to his practice. But you should certainly consider this. It may be the right option for you. Maybe it won't be. But it's definitely one thing that you should definitely, you know, think about long and hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anyone, like to your point, has any questions, ask away, shoot me an email. I'm always at the major conference like Askers and Academy. So if you see me, pop in, wave in, say hey, more than happy to, you know, chat with you about me on my journey so far.
Awesome. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I know you'll keep doing great things.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
And I want to remind my viewers and listeners, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every week, every Sunday. It's on Apple, Amazon, Google, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast, plus it's on cataractcoach.com, and the full videos on YouTube. And we're going to have Dr. Tran's lecture attached to the end of this right after I zip my mouth. And also remember, please tell your friends. That's how we grow, word of mouth. Wow, that was a great podcast. I learned so much and I really enjoyed it. What a great young ophthalmologist. I'm so proud to have him as part of our field and our future of ophthalmology. Now, coming up here is going to be his YouTube video of a presentation he gave that explains about his journey into private practice as a solo practitioner. Check it out.
So, without further ado, how to start your own medical practice. Did you know that 50 to 80% of ophthalmologists will quit their first job within the first 3 years? That's an alarmingly high number. It makes sense though. In residency, you get amazing training so you can take care of complex cataracts, crazy plastics, and retina cases. But no one ever talks about the business side of medicine. What about contract negotiations, financial wellness, and so on and so forth? And something as simple as what type of jobs are out there. In fact, I go into in-depth in a different video, but in summary, there's four main types of jobs. The first is academics. It's the one that you're most familiar with if you're in residency. But with academics, there is some red tape. The next category is what I call your employed jobs. So these are things like working at a VA, Kaiser, or even a private equity, private practice group. Here, there's still some red tape. It's still well-structured, but there's really not opportunity for equity. But the benefits tend to be pretty good, though. In the third category, I have private practice. Here, there's a little bit less red tape, you have a little bit more responsibility and more admin work, but there's usually a chance for equity, whether it's in the ASC or the practice itself. And of course, the final category is being a solo owner. Here, you have the least red tape, but you definitely have the most admin work. And as a solo owner, you have complete control and equity in your company. Solo is definitely a way to go, but is it the way you should go? The answer is, it depends. Think about your med school class. In your med school class, you had those going into pathology, those going into dermatology, those going into pediatrics and radiology. And guess what? All of your classmates are pretty happy in their fields. My point in bringing this up is that there is no one perfect type of job, and it depends on you and your personality. I would recommend by starting to look at three things though. Look at the pay structure, look at your hours, and look to see if it has those small factors that could make you happy. And with that, you should be able to find some form of work-life balance. For me, that meant going solo and being my own boss. But solo was one that I had the least amount of knowledge about. But luckily, Here's how you do it. So our Askers meeting was held in May, and we're going to set up a sample scenario where in about 7 to 8 months later, we're going to open our medical practice. In the first month, the most important thing you need to do is location research. That starts by figuring out your non-compete. Do you have a non-compete? If you're from California, congratulations, you can skip this step. But for others, you need to read your contract very carefully and see what your non-compete is. Next, you need to find your competition. Google Maps is a very powerful tool. You can search for ophthalmologists in a given neighborhood to see where your potential competition might be. Next, you should look at where your potential referrals might be coming from. Do you have friends in primary care? Good optometry referrals? Is there certain things that make you unique, like a special language or specialty training? Because that can help you stand out. Now that you have your area kind of defined, you can go on loopnet.com and start searching for commercial real estate properties. Loopnet.com is kind of like Zillow for commercial real estate spaces. Here are some things I think you should be looking for your very first office. Look for about 1,500 to 2,000 square feet. That's enough for 1 or 2 exam lanes, a diagnostic room, a waiting room, a procedure room, a break room, your personal office. It's a very adequate size space. Now with just over 6 months to go, you should be doing a lot of the critical paperwork. The first is to get your state medical license. Each state is a little bit different, but usually you can find it on Google. Also, at this point, you should be applying for the NPI-1 number. That is the NPI number specific to you as the provider. We will be doing the NPI-2 later, which has to do with your practice that you set up. The website for the NPI-1 is right there. Also, you should be updating your CAQH. CAQH is your Council for Affordable Quality Healthcare. It's essentially a single database that has all your updated information, and this is where your insurance companies will pull your credentialing information from. Also, at this stage, you should be working on getting your LLC set up and your tax ID. The LLC process is pretty quick, and again, you can go on Google and search your state how to start an LLC. The second thing you need to find out is your tax ID. A business has a specific tax ID number called an EIN, and EIN stands for Employer Identification Number. This is kind of like your own medical practice social security number, and you apply directly at the IRS website. With about 5 months to go, you should be working on financing. And financing a medical practice can be pretty expensive, so you need to have good plans. Either plan A, you apply for traditional financing, plan B, you have saved up a lot of money from your previous job, or plan C, have a rich uncle. But I kid, how expensive is it?
I have to take over the audio here for Dr. Tran because he used copyrighted music in his video. So he's saying you need about $150,000 to $300,000 to start the practice. You need to get your credentialing done. Takes months. You got to do this well in advance. It can take a lot of time and a lot of effort. Be creative now. When you start your new practice, your logo, your website design, the practice name, you have an opportunity to basically do things the way you want it to be done. And that's a really nice benefit of doing a solo private practice. And so he talks about now credit cards. You definitely need to get some business credit cards and how to do that. He has a couple links for this, etc. And you need to set up all your appropriate banking information with your bank. And so all these things, again, take some time. He says, make sure you get the credit cards, your NPI-2 number, your malpractice insurance has to be done, credentialing with ASCs, getting on the various surgical panels for where you want to operate. These are all very important things that you have to accomplish here. Remember the difference between an occurrence policy and a claims-made policy. It's for your malpractice insurance. And remember, do you need to get a tail? You got to think about all these things when you're leaving your practice. So again, I had to take over the audio here for Dr. Tran because, again, he used copyrighted music, which, as you know, is a no-go. You can't do that. It's a copyright violation. So we muted out his section, which has his audio, and I'll just continue here. Again, the final timeline is you got to get the equipment you need for your practice, and the equipment can be very expensive. And so you can either get a loan. He says you can borrow money for the bank, or maybe you have a rich uncle and things of that nature. Let me let him take over.
QED system, $3,000 to $5,000 for a tonopentin eye care, $3,000 to $5,000 for a four-opter, $3,000 to $5,000 for an exam chair and stand, $5,000 for an auto lensometer, $5,000 to $10,000 for an auto refractor, $15,000 for a slit lamp, $20,000 to $40,000 for a visual field, $30,000 to $70,000 for your OCT, $30,000 to $70,000 for your YAG SLT laser, $30,000 to $80,000 for your biometer.
It's gone.
$300,000 quickly spent. Does it always have to be that expensive? Well, the answer is no. You can always buy used, and you can look for equipment that serves the same purpose that are much cheaper. So for example, the IOL Master 700 is above $50,000. You can get a nice used Lemstar for under $25,000. As a silver lining though, by spending that much money, you're gonna have a lot of travel points. So enjoy your trip to Europe. For me, I kept my budget under $125,000. Now you also need to figure out which EMR you want to use. There's a lot of great companies out there. There's of course ModMed, Epic, so on and so forth. So it's all personal preference, but you also need to get your business license at this point. So that involves a trip to your local courthouse. Now with 1 month to go, let's hammer in the final details. That means getting your business cards in line, hiring your staff, putting all the equipment into the office, and of course, building out your furniture. I had a lot of fun at this stage, so I'm gonna show you a clip of me building my office out. But if you stay structured, I know you can do it. Best of luck on your journey in opening up your solo practice. And as always, thanks for watching.